What would we do without pockets? I wouldn't be able to record the lectures. I'd have to have a microphone. Clipped. Too many things. Okay. Here we go. I think we're on the last battery, too. We may make it. All right. No other questions for Talia? Thank you for getting those done, Talia. Two business things. I need to speak to the note taker after. Okay, just for a minute. And the second is, what was the second? Oh yes, I gave one of you a copy of the book and you didn't have any money, and I have a note that says you owe me money. So, any other business? Nope. Okay. On top of that, I just broke a fingernail. Whew. That's as far out as I can go. Exercise 2. Do Wednesday. Do either A or B. Don't do both unless you just really want to do both. And these are in the syllabus and on the web. The first one asks you to describe two important dyads you participate in with different people, and then explain for each of those dyads the properties of affect, power, and reciprocity that the relations in those dyads exhibit. Okay? So, the criterion for that you need to be describing two different dyads. You will participate in each of them, but each of them is with somebody else, two different people. And for each, describe the affect, the power, and the reciprocity in such a way that it's clear that you understand what affect means, and reciprocity and power. So give examples if you can. Don't just say the reciprocity is really good. That tells us you know the language, but it doesn't tell us that you understand what reciprocity means. Okay? So tell us, give us an example of the reciprocity or the lack of reciprocity in the particular relationship. Okay? And the alternative assignment, B, is to describe one important setting in your ecosystem, and we're going to talk about settings today. And then, after you describe that setting, describe the microsystem that exists in it. And we will also talk about that today, and of course, both of those concepts are in the book. That's a more difficult task, to describe the pattern of roles, relationships, and activities that happens in that particular setting. But some of you are up to that task, I'm sure, and would like to try it. Okay? And if you're going to tackle that one, what we'll be looking for is the description of the setting. A setting has to be a place, physical place. And the microsystem is the pattern of roles, relations, and activities that happen in that particular place. And we'll expand a little more on what that means, what a pattern is, today. Okay? So that's due Wednesday. And if you have any questions about it, if you have any questions about it, we could ask them now. You could ask them, we might answer them. Okay. You all had a good Groundhog Day? Right? Yeah? Who had the best groundhog dish? You did eat groundhog, right? No? Okay. Well, we'd be happy to share our recipes with you. Okay, we have talked... We have talked about activities, we've talked about roles, we've talked about relations, and those are the three elements in our lives. They happen in places. And the notion of setting is Rontgenbrenner's attempt to help us think about the environment that we live in. Can we define the environment as a collection of settings? It's a useful concept, I think, because it forces us to think about where we are talking about. And sociologists and psychologists tend to talk about activities and they talk about roles, but one of the difficulties we have in talking about, in thinking ecologically, is that we tend not to think about specific settings. If you're going to talk about an ecosystem, you're going to talk about the environment, it is necessary to have some way to capture the features of that environment. So what do I mean by that? Well, sociologists and psychologists, psychiatrists, want to talk about the family. Okay, great, the family. And we talk about the family this and the family that, but if you're going to understand the family, as we're going to try to do in the rest of this course, it's helpful to think about where that family is. What is the setting in which we family? I talked about parent as a verb and child as a verb. Where do I child? We also family. You ever think about it as a verb? When I family, what am I doing? When I'm being a member of my family or playing family roles or engaging in family activities, it's an interesting shorthand to try out on people to say, I'm familying. We're going to family this weekend, whatever it is that we do with family members. It's helpful for us to try to think about where we family. Where does the family exist? And then if we're going to talk about how the family relates to other places, like the family and school relationship, how do we talk about that? What is the relationship between school, which I can define as a place, and family? Where is that happening? Can I talk about the family when I call from work and nobody else in the family is there, but I call from work to talk to a teacher? Am I being a member of the family? Maybe. Am I familying? Maybe. But is a call from work part of the function of the family? We get into difficulty when we talk about families without being able to talk about the places where we are engaged in whatever it is we think of as family. The same thing with school. When you talk about education as a process, where does it happen? Is education the process that I'm going through when I'm doing my homework at home? Or when I'm having lunch with a professor? Or is education something that only happens in a school building? Well, if we're going to talk about school and the family's relationship to school, we need to be able to specify where schooling is taking place, where education is taking place, and where the family is taking place. And while this may seem a little Why is this important? One of the things that we'll look at in the ecosystem as we try to describe family, for example, looking at the home-school relationship or the relationship between the family and school, is if family is taking place in one setting and school is taking place in another setting, and we can't find activities that cross if the parents never go to school, if homework or teachers or studying never come home, then we can say that those two settings are not very well connected. On the other hand, if the parents are involved at home in the homework which the teacher sends home, and that helps the child's learning and therefore performance in the classroom, then we can say, well, there's a connection here. There's an activity the family is engaging in that is supporting what goes on in the classroom. So we'll be looking at the overlap and the connection between different settings. And in order to do that, we have to start with the notion of a setting. Very simple notion. Okay. A setting is a place with definable physical features. This is a place. This is a setting. In a setting, people can have face-to-face interactions. Other settings may be, or other places may be very important to you, but they may not be particularly important in understanding development, because you can't have any interactions there, so there's no way to talk about a relation there. My car might be a setting, except that if I'm in it by myself and there's no relationship going on there, then the fact that I spend a great deal of time in my car may have implications for what I do in settings, but if I can't have a face-to-face interaction or a cheek-to-cheek interaction, at least, and don't have face-to-face interactions when you're driving. Right? If you regularly commute with somebody else and you do talk with somebody in the car, then it might be a setting that would be important to look at. But if it's a place where I go all by myself and I don't engage in any relationship there, there's nobody to have a complementary role, then it's probably not a setting from Bronfenbrenner's point of view. You can nitpick at that if you want, and I'm not going to defend his notion particularly well, or particularly vigorously. I'm going to say, whatever. A setting, typically, if I'm interested in it, it is probably a place where there are relations. Because if there's only one person, then I can't have a system of roles, relations, and activities, so it doesn't have a microsystem in it. So forget it. But if you want to include it in your notion of the ecosystem, my car with me in it by myself, that's okay. But take his definition and his description of it as a starting point. So, any setting can be described, and when we look at proposition F in his system, as you have already in the book, what you will read is that the specific characteristics of settings determine what can happen there, so the activities in a particular setting will be determined by the physical characteristics of that setting. That we're not going to have swimming races in this room. The relationships are shaped by the particular characteristics, the physical characteristics of the setting. It's really hard to have small group discussion in this setting. It was designed for a particular kind of relation and particular roles. This room was deliberately designed to have one, maybe two people down here talking at you. I've got the microphone. I've got the controls. I have the power. My role is to dispense information, to entertain, whatever else goes with that role. Yours is to be a passive audience, receiving. Educationally, that sucks. But here we are in a big class. The room, the physical setting, shapes what will happen. You don't have microphones. You have places to set your laptops or to take notes. Sleeping is difficult, you've noticed, because the seats aren't high enough and they don't recline far enough. So the seats were designed, the physical characteristics of the room were designed to try to keep you awake. The seats are uncomfortable. These are better than others. They don't recline. There's no place to put your head. You will be punished by a crick in your neck if you go to sleep, or you will fall sideways when you nod off, or you'll go this way, and it'll be really uncomfortable. So the room is designed to discourage sleeping, to encourage a teacher role defined as purveyor of entertainment or information, and to do that to a passive audience. Your residence hall, your particular room in the residence hall, has particular characteristics. It is designed more or less well to promote certain kinds of activities. Hard to have two tables of bridge in your room, right? You've tried. Hard to maintain a relationship with somebody. The beds are too small. The bunk beds, right? You're on a loft. Somebody falls out. This is bad for the relationship. She kicked me out of bed accidentally. The furniture is designed so you have to sleep alone or very cozily. I'm not going there anymore. I'm off that topic. It's designed to encourage very close friendships with your roommate, right? Very close. One of the challenges of residence hall living is designed into the rooms. You will learn to deal with conflict, because the room is designed to create and promote conflict. So we want you to learn to deal with conflict effectively. It's built right into it. You're paying your tuition or your room and board to learn to deal with conflict. I went to a college that said, we don't need to promote conflict. We don't care if you learn to deal with it. So we had a suite for two of us, two tiny bedrooms with tiny closets and a living room and our own bathroom for the two of us. And we got along great. Very little conflict. In fact, I don't remember ever having conflict with my suite mate for 3 years, who is still one of my best friends. But we've never learned to deal with conflict with each other. It just hasn't been there. Okay. The point? Your life is full of settings. You can make a list. You can describe any number of them, and they will make up the settings in your ecosystem. That's where your life is lived and where your development happens. It's not the only feature of your ecosystem, but it is the fundamental feature in your ecosystem. You have a bunch of settings. Okay. Different kinds of settings give rise to distinctive patterns of role, activity, and relation. Okay. And what that's going to do is move us to the notion of a microsystem, because this says pattern of role, relation, and activity. In every setting, Bronfenbrenner says, there is a system of roles, relations, and activities. And you're going to learn to say that over and over and over again in your sleep. A microsystem is the pattern of roles, relationships, and activities that exists in the awareness of a particular person in a particular setting. So when you try to describe the setting of this room, your dorm room, where you work, a party, wherever you are that's in a place, where there are people, there will be roles, relations, and activities, and they will occur in a particular pattern. And that pattern is in part shaped by the physical characteristics of the setting. It is also shaped by the roles that are encouraged in that setting, by the activities that are expected and permitted in that setting, and by the relations that happen between people, particularly over time. Okay? So, we have settings, and in every setting there is a small system, or a big system if it's a big setting, that is unique to that particular setting, though it may share characteristics with the microsystems in other settings. The microsystem is a pattern of activities, roles, and interpersonal relations experienced by the developing person in a given setting with particular physical and material characteristics. That's what I just said. I just said it again. I just turned the sentence around to focus on the microsystem. Now, there's an important point philosophically and psychologically here that Bronfenbrenner raises in this definition. It's the pattern of activities, roles, and interpersonal relations experienced by the developing person. So if we're going to try to define the pattern, the microsystem, we're going to think about the person whose perspective we're trying to understand. It might be yours, it might be a child's, it might be your grandmother's. That's the developing person, and we're going to look at the pattern of roles, relationships, and activities. In other words, a particular setting might have activities that go on in it, but if they are not experienced by the person we're thinking about, they're not part of that person's microsystem. Okay. So, we'll go back to your childhood home as a setting. There may have been lots of things that went on there that you were unaware of. They were not part of your microsystem. Your parents making love. Your parents arguing, if they were the kinds of parents who argued without letting you be aware of it. Your older brother's drug use that you were unaware of. Those may have been activities that went on, but if you were not aware of them, if you were not experiencing it, they were not part of your microsystem. I'm sorry? Yes. Yes. They occurred in the setting, but they were not part of your microsystem. Exactly. They may have influenced what happened, but you may not have been aware of them or their influence. For example, it's fairly common that children are unaware of particular aspects of their parents' activities and relationship, and they're often surprised when their parents separate and divorce because they did not understand the kinds of conflict that was going on in the parents' relation. So it's a surprise. If it's not part of your experience, it's a surprise when the microsystem changes in an unexpected fashion. One of the parents moves out. And then you want to know why. It's a mystery. What was going on that I didn't understand? What did I not know? Okay, so it's an important point philosophically because most of psychology and sociology make the claim that there is some kind of objective reality, that we can describe the pattern of activities, roles, and relations, for example. And there's a reality out there that people are all exposed to. And if we understand that reality, we'll understand their behavior. Bronfenbrenner is saying, probably not. If I want to understand what's going on for a particular person, it is probably more important to try to get into that person's experience. Things may be happening in the environment that the person is unaware of, and they are probably not having the immediate effect that the experience the person is having will be having on that person. It's a phenomenological approach that says the phenomena that I'm experiencing are the ones that are important, whether they're real or not. If I think we're having a great relationship and the affect is positive, that's what counts. Not your objective measure of the positive affect in our relationship. It's what I feel is going on. It's my personal subjective experience from which I'm developing. And philosophers will have an argument about that. I had an argument at the dinner table not long ago with a philosophy major about that issue. And I said, argue if you want whether there's an objective reality. I'm attracted to the notion that there isn't any objective reality, but I'm glad that I can make you exist, because my day would be really dull if I didn't conjure you up in my subjective reality. So I'm glad you're out there, even if I do imagine you. That's taking it a little too far. But for Bronfenbrenner, if we don't understand the experience the person is having and take that as the person's reality, then we are likely to get off track when we try to understand why the person is developing in a particular way. So try to find out what the person's experience is, what is the pattern in the system, in the microsystem, in the setting that the person is experiencing. And we will come to that again when we look at the mesosystem, because for the description and analysis of a particular person's ecosystem, we have to define it from that person's perspective. So some settings will be in what he calls the mesosystem, because I've got to straighten out my pronouns. A person will have a mesosystem composed of the settings in which that person actually participates. And then there'll be other settings the person doesn't participate in that will be perhaps influencing his or her development. They're called the exosystem, outside. The mesosystem has to be defined from the particular person's point of view by his or her participation. My mesosystem will be different from my parents' mesosystem or even my spouse's mesosystem because we participate in different settings. And what may be a very important mesosystem setting for me, one that I participate in, may not be one that my child participates in. It'll be in the child's exosystem. So it'll be simultaneously a mesosystem setting for me and an exosystem setting for my child. And the only way to keep that straight is to think about the person as the center of his or her ecosystem. And whether a setting is meso or exo will depend on whose person we're looking at. Okay. That'll become important when you screw it up the first time in trying to describe an ecosystem. But we will take care of those questions. If you're going to look at a particular setting, like a family home, a household, then from Bronfenbrenner's point of view, you have to look at the whole thing. The whole interpersonal system operating in that setting, all the relations, all the roles, and all the activities. They are all related to each other. Each dyad is affecting each other dyad. The activities of one may be affecting the activities of the other indirectly. Even though we said you may be unaware of them, they may still be affecting you, and it'll be important to look at it. A particular setting interests us because settings either do or do not promote our development, or they promote our development in a particular way. The developmental potential of the setting will depend on its ability to promote activities from which the person can learn. Relationships that are positive and roles that are complex and stretch the person. So what you're going to be looking at in any particular setting is what does it do to motivate you to engage in progressively more complex molar activities, patterns of reciprocal interaction, and primary dyadic relationships. In other words, does the system engage that exists in that setting engage the person in activities and roles and activities that are going to promote development? And in development of what? Development of reading skills, of interpersonal skills, of aggressive nastiness. What is the particular setting going to be promoting for the developing individual? And it's both the physical environment and the social environment, the relationships and roles that exist in that particular setting. And finally, for this point, Bronfenbrenner suggests that if we see that two kinds of settings, two different settings, have different effects on development, we should be able to understand those effects by looking at the microsystem in each setting, the particular pattern of roles, relationships, and activities. And they should be different. If I see, for example, that a particular school works very well to put its kids up to the next level, its students, and if it has few behavior problems, and its students go on to good college performance, and I see another school, ideally in the same neighborhood for the example, that doesn't do that. It has a lot of behavior problems, a lot of trouble, kids don't do very well, they don't pass, they don't go on to college, they end up in jail, whatever the results are. If I see those different patterns, the different results, I should be able to look at those schools and look at the microsystems that exist in them and see contrasts. And I will. If I see families that have very different children, I will probably see very different microsystems in their households. And Bronfenbrenner says we need to look at the proximal processes going on in those microsystems if we don't like what's coming out of them, if we don't like the development that's taking place in them. We need to look at how we can influence the activities, the roles, and the relationships to change those particular settings. And that's the sort of ultimate developmental challenge. How can I do that? Okay, questions about settings? And what is one? Because you need to do it if you're doing part A. Part B, I mean, of the exercise. Excellent question, because it raises one of the common problems. And this was actually a problem that Bronfenbrenner stumbled into and tripped himself up with. At one point, as you perhaps read in the book, Bronfenbrenner talked about your social life as a setting. Your social life is not a setting. It's an activity or a set of activities that happens in particular settings. So, is the basketball team a setting? No. Rat. Sorry, Nicole. The basketball team is probably a set of relationships, probably a set of roles. It exists in a variety of settings. But it is not a setting. The gymnasium is a setting. The locker room is a setting. The team bus is a setting. Team meetings happen in a setting. And then you can describe the activities. Practices are activity. Not quite. This is where you have to begin to shape your thinking into thinking about specific settings rather than the general activities. As it says in the book, as I suggested in the book, the university may be a setting. University is a very, very big complex setting, so we might want to think about subsettings. Patrick Gym is clearly a setting, and particular things go on there. So, depending on what you're trying to analyze, the gymnasium may be a setting that you want to talk about, and you may want to think about the university as a whole series of settings, or the university is a big setting, and the gymnasium is one of the subsettings. Marsh Life Science is a subsetting. The library is a subsetting. You get to choose the level at which you want to say, I'm talking about a setting. If I'm talking about your life here on campus, then I'm going to talk about the variety of settings on campus. But if I'm interested in your whole life, then I'm going to think about campus as a setting, big one, complex, your work site as a setting, and your household where you grew up or where your parents live as a setting. Then I'm going to look at the relations between those settings. So the decision depends on what level you're trying to understand. But coming back to the basketball team, basketball is a collection of activities. It's a collection of roles and relationships. And what is important in thinking about being a member of the basketball team is what are the roles, relationships, and activities that go on in the various settings in which you identified as a basketball player. But the basketball team is not a setting. And we will run into other examples like that. Your social life is not a setting. It is a complex activity that happens in several different settings. Playing basketball is an activity that happens in several different settings. Well, it probably only happens in gymnasiums for the most part, but your role as a basketball player, which is part of your identity as a basketball team member, carries over into different settings. Good. Thank you for that question, because I needed to make that point, or try to. It'll come back. Other questions about settings? There will be. Okay. So, let's talk about the we need to get into the passage of time now. And this is the simplest piece of the ecosystem developmentally. We often developmentally get interested or excited or discouraged about what happens when people move into a new role or a new setting. And Bronfenbrenner focuses our attention on those by saying that an ecological transition is one of the important things that we're going to look at. So an ecological transition happens whenever you change your role or your setting, or both. So you went from home to college. That's a change in setting. There are changes in roles. You went from being a high school student to being a college student. You start a new job. You become a new employee or a different kind of employee, so your role changes. You get engaged. You are now a fiancé instead of a boyfriend, girlfriend. The role changes. It's subtle and it's important, but it will change. You decide to move in with your significant other, cohabiting. This upsets your grandparents. It may upset your parents. They may forget that they also did it and upset your grandparents as well. But you change your role and your setting when you decide to live together, when you actually do it. You move into the setting together. You're now sharing a setting. For one of you, at least, it's a new setting. You move into his apartment or her apartment. They don't change setting, but you do. And you both change your role. You're now cohabiting significant others. And you may not think of yourself as having changed role, but very quickly, for most of you, you will discover that the role has changed. And the relationship changes as a result of that. What you expect of each other has changed because you're now cohabiting. You're creating a new microsystem. We're going to look at that in more detail in the second unit. But for now, any ecological transition involves a change either in role or setting or both. And what's going to be important about that is that Bronfenbrenner is interested in what happens to us when we go into new roles or when we enter new settings. Because it's there that our development is challenged. When we move into a new setting, we have the new task. The new setting always gives us the task of figuring out what's going on in it. That's the challenge in development. Anytime you enter a new setting, you have to figure out what's going on in it and learn the microsystem. You have to learn to go with the flow there. You have to figure out what your role is in that new setting. And you have to figure out how to relate to and engage in the activities that are expected in that new setting. So anytime you change settings, go through an ecological transition, you are challenged to learn something, to adapt. Okay. and that may be stressful. Anytime you go into a new role, you have to learn something new, how to play that role, how playing that role will affect all the rest of your relations, how it will interact with your other roles, what the activities are. Okay. So these are the times that are ripe for learning. Ecological transitions are the challenges in life, potentially. And if you look at human development, it is a series of ecological transitions. If you look at the beginning establishment of a relationship that evolves into a family, that involves into perhaps parenting, grandparenting, you're going through ecological transitions constantly, and they are the sources of stress often, and they are what we often are trying to help people deal with, either in advance by educating them about what will happen, giving them the skills, helping them develop the skills that will make them successful in their new role as elementary school teacher or nurse. Or we help them deal with the difficulties that they've had in dealing with the transition that they're going through. So ecological transitions will become a focus and often a significant part of what it is we're trying to understand. Settings, ecological transitions, and within each setting, a microsystem. And the microsystem, as I indicated, is the pattern of roles, relations, and activities. If we're going to talk about systems, we need to think about the essentials of systems theory. What makes something a system? A system, as I said in the introductory couple of lectures, a system is a whole, an entity composed of parts or components, each of which is connected to some other components, and the sum of which work in some way to make something happen. And in general system theory, what we look at is what are the components, how are they connected to each other, and how does a change in one influence the relationship that one has with the others, and how does a change in any one part of the system change the output of that system, or the effects of that system, or how that system works. If we're talking about a system, we should be able to talk about change in any component. Change in any component may bring the whole system crashing down. Think internet, the power grid, keeps it from functioning. Change in a person in a family system may make it impossible for the family to provide a safe, developmentally facilitating location for its members. For Bronfenbrenner, it's essential that we think systems, that all of the settings that you're in are related to each other. All of the activities that you engage in any of those settings, affect your relationships with the other settings, potentially. And any of the relationships you're in those settings, may affect your roles and your activities. So they're not separable except for the purposes of our analysis. We can focus on one and then the other. But in order to understand your development, your life, which is what we're trying to do, we need to be able to put them together. We need to be able to see how the components influence each other. For you in your ecosystem, how does your work influence your studying? How does your family influence your work and your studying? How does your relationship, your significant relationship, your romantic relationship influence your friendships? How does your romantic significant relationship influence your relationship with your parents and vice versa? And the bottom line is everything is connected to everything else potentially. And we need to think about them in all their complexity. Think about everything being connected to everything else and potentially influencing it. Then we'll sort out what are the important ways things are connected, what are the important ways things influence each other in this system. And the system is your ecosystem, your life. A family is also a system, a system of relationships. It exists in a larger ecosystem. But the individuals play different roles and have different relations with each other and engage in different activities. And we'll look at how those change as the family, wherever it starts, goes through time. So we'll be thinking simultaneously of several different kinds of systems. The microsystem happening in any particular setting, the family system, which is happening wherever it's happening and whenever it's happening, and the larger ecosystem as the settings are relating to each other. So think systems. And you can review that in the book. But as we're looking at social systems, particularly like families, they're made up of components. And they behave in the components, the people engage in particular roles, particular activities, they behave in specific ways. Okay. And then, as we look at any system, what we're looking for are a couple of features. One is equilibrium. Okay. Every system has a kind of steady state. And the system works in that state, and if you change it much, it may not work at all. Your car, for example. If everything is together and hooked up right, and the fuel is appropriate and the spark is hot enough, your car will start, it'll run, it'll do its thing. But as you know, it's a complex system. And if you muck up any particular thing, no spark, your battery's dead. Okay. No gas. Car doesn't go. Tires are flat. It may go, but you will not like the results. Okay. Steering cable is broken. Okay. You got to put all those parts together, and then they will run. And on a morning like today, if you started your car, it may have run a little rough because it was cold. Your automobile is designed to run most efficiently at a particular temperature, internal temperature. And it'll run rough, it'll be inefficient, until it reaches that point to which it is engineered and tuned. And then when it gets warm enough, then its efficiency increases. And we'll call that, for the sake of illustration, the equilibrium point. If it gets too hot, it starts to become inefficient again. So it has a series of components and settings that are designed to get it to its most efficient state as quickly as possible and keep it there. That's what it's looking for. In a living system, the process is a little looser. Every living system has an equilibrium state, which is where all the components are roughly in balance and can do their thing and move along, and it'll probably fluctuate around an equilibrium point. And it may spend very little time actually in equilibrium. Living systems tend to be in a perpetual state of falling out of and trying to get back to equilibrium. Your body temperature is an example of that. You have a metabolic rate that changes constantly. It changes the way you burn energy, how much you burn, so that you can generate enough heat to keep you sort of around 98.6, which probably very few of you are at any particular time. I have not been measured at 98.6?
Yeah.
I haven't topped 98 except when I was sick for years. I go give blood. They take my temperature. Oh, 97.4. I go to the doctor and get my checkup. Oh, 97.8. I don't top 98 unless I'm sick. My body is relatively in equilibrium. Does that mean I'm not human because I don't get up to 98.6, which is average? No. I don't know. There may be other indicators that I'm not human, but that one isn't it. My body has found an equilibrium point in metabolic rate and burning energy and my heat loss that lets me stay lower, and I'm happy there. My body is happy there. If it starts to go up and my temperature gets up toward what you would think of as normal, then I start peeling off clothes and cool down, stop burning energy as quickly, and stop producing as much heat so I can cool down to the equilibrium point. If I start to cool down too much, then I start to move around, put a sweater on to conserve heat, start burning calories faster, whatever will get me back to that equilibrium point. That equilibrium point is the average that I oscillate around. I'm always moving away from it or trying to get back to it. In a relationship, there are many ways in which a relationship has its own equilibrium as a system, as a two-person system. And we are typically always trying to maintain the equilibrium in the two-person system of a relationship by our actions, by our words, by being together or being apart. We're trying to keep the affect positive. We're trying to keep our interest, trying to keep the other person's interest. And much of our interpersonal behavior is trying to either move us closer to each other, increase the positive affect, or separate us from each other because we're getting anxious about losing ourselves in the relationship. And we're at the same time trying to keep the relationship comfortable with our other roles and activities and relationships. So we do things like say, well, I need to study this weekend. That's okay, right? I still love you. I still like you. I want to be with you, but not this weekend because I need to study. I have a deadline. I have to work. So we explain to try to keep the relationship at a comfortable point. And each of us is trying to do that in a transactional way. So it's a system. One of us is feeling neglected. He or she makes noises. The other person responds to those. Oh, you're feeling neglected. I'm sorry. And, you know, I really do like you. Please don't feel neglected. Please, you know, I'll write you a love poem. I'll send you flowers. You know, whatever it is. I'll do whatever it is to maintain the equilibrium in our relationship. A family as a system works to maintain a comfortable set of relationships, not just one, but a whole set of them. And it deals with the emotions that are brought into the family by individuals that impact a particular relationship or an activity. So it's trying to maintain the family in a particular setting is trying to maintain a set of comfortable relationships that let everybody feel good about being in the family and being alive and being here and loved and cared about. And we have this complex set of relationships, and relationship activities that are designed to get us through the day, take care of our basic needs, help us feel loved, and feel close to each other. It's an emotional system, and it has an equilibrium point. If there's too much closeness, we may want to withdraw from the family a little bit. If there's too much communication, we may want to turn our cell phone off. If there's not enough, we may want to write a letter home. Hey, Mom, you still there? We do things to create and to moderate, control the emotional relationships among us. And we're at a point in any particular family of either moving toward that comfortable state or falling away from that comfortable state. And families develop skills to get back to whatever they think the best relationship is. In a particular setting, say home, the family operates as a system, and the components are the people and their roles and their relations and the activities that they engage in. And they create a system together so that the stuff that needs to get done gets done and everybody can feel reasonably comfortable and loved. And that may mean for the family doing the activities that are important to help people through their day outside. For example, how many of you had mothers or fathers who encouraged you to eat a good breakfast before you went to school? Of course. That is a parental responsibility. Part of the parent's role is to make sure there is food, literally putting food on the table or in the refrigerator, and then on the table, and making sure that the members of the family have the opportunity to have a nutritious breakfast so that they can go out and meet the world in a healthy state. That's part of the pattern, the role and the activity. And some of you hate breakfast. You get up in the morning, you don't like morning, and you probably had a battle with Mom or Dad for years. You wanted to sleep until you absolutely had just enough time to throw your clothes on, maybe brush your teeth, pick up your books, and get on the bus or get to school, right? Your pattern didn't fit with the family pattern of wanting you to have a healthy breakfast. So you have this fight because there's Mom's role, parents' role, the activity of eating, and you went off. And you may not be the kind of person who likes food in the morning. Many of you don't. Your stomachs don't like food in the morning. That's a perfectly normal thing to do. There are people who go their entire lives without eating a nutritious breakfast until noon. And they get up at 6 o'clock, they get up at 5 o'clock. My brother-in-law is one of these. He gets up, he takes his very, very weak coffee, and he goes to work. And he drinks the coffee on his way to work. And along the way, at some point, he may have a little bit of lunch. And he's perfectly happy. That's the way his metabolism works. And then he comes home and he eats a nice dinner. And he essentially eats one big square meal a day. If you insisted that and my sister has stopped insisting, she used to, because that was her role, right? Keep him healthy. He would probably get nauseous. His body does not like food in the morning. And he would probably get nauseous. And if you really insisted, probably at 6 o'clock, it would reject bacon and eggs and toast. It would reject it. And you wouldn't like the result. He doesn't eat it. What he did was grow up in a family that insisted on healthy meals at breakfast. He married into one. We always eat healthy breakfast. And you create a pattern around that with some conflict, maybe some excuses. If you don't eat a healthy breakfast, and the kids will think they don't have to eat a healthy breakfast. Parents have to be role models, activity models, good eater models. The family is creating a system, a microsystem, that pattern of roles, relationships, and activities that carries out all of its responsibilities, takes care of everybody, and to the extent possible, adapts to the individualities of each person. But each family is different. Each microsystem is different. Equilibrium and disequilibrium. If any part of the system changes, it tends to change the system to move it away from its equilibrium state, and it will attempt to resist that change. If the system is in an equilibrium state, if it's got a stable pattern, if you try to change any part of it, the system will resist that. That's built into systems. They will resist change. Okay? They will resist it, and then gradually, if the new addition persists, they will gradually modify the system so that it becomes stable again and everybody will be comfortable. Life, for many of us, is essentially a process of adapting to changes in our important systems. And that's how the systems change. And along the way, we may develop new roles, new activities, different ways of doing them, new relations, and a changed system, a change in the microsystem. Change in a microsystem may come from any different source, a new activity, a new role, a change in a person, developmental change in a person, menopause, puberty, an accident, learning to walk, learning to read, going to high school, leaving for college. Any of those changes will change the entire system. The whole system has to adapt to the developmental changes that happen just simply because we get older and our skills change and our roles change and our relations change. The challenge, if you take it in part B for exercise two, is to pick a setting and then see if you can figure out what the pattern of roles, relations, and activities is. Think about a day or a week. Now, who are the people? How do they relate to each other? Who is typically in this system, this microsystem? Does it change on a regular basis or is it very stable? See if you can capture the whole system. And we'll see you on Wednesday.